So it's been a few years now that it was shown that if one had an accelerated observer or an accelerated detector, that this detector would see the vacuum fluctuations of some field, whatever field it was, scalar field, which is what I'm going to be interested in here, or electromagnetic field, or neutrino field, or whatever, as having a temperature of proportional to the acceleration, equal to the acceleration over 2 pi, times a very small number. So to get a temperature of about 1 Kelvin, you need an acceleration of about 10 to the 21 meters per second squared, which is a hefty acceleration. This is one of the reasons why this effect has actually never been measured, although a very closely related effect has been seen, namely that if you stick an electron into a circular orbit, one gets a similar effect. The temperature, it's not exactly thermal. It turns out in that case that the temperature is frequency dependent, slightly frequency dependent. But what that would cause was that if you stuck an electron which was polarized into one of these synchrotrons, that electron would eventually partially depolarize. The electron would be in a magnetic field because it's whirling around the synchrotron. The spin of the electron would be polarized as well, so one of the spins would have a higher energy than the other. And if you stick this into a thermal bath, you get a thermal distribution between the spins being up and down. And one of the things that you do get in these synchrotrons is that, in fact, these population levels, you cannot keep the electron perfectly polarized. It will always depolarize itself to a factor about 92%. And due to its interaction with the quantum fluctuations of the electromagnetic field. It turns out that that particular problem is particularly difficult because it turns out that there are, in a sense, two thermometers. One of them is that you have this weak focusing, so the electron, as it goes around its orbit, can oscillate up and down. That's a simple harmonic oscillator. So that acts as a thermometer, and the electron itself has its spin acting as a thermometer. And the problem is, as the electron bounces up and down, just due to Fermi-Walker transport, that actually causes the spin also to jump levels, if you will. So you get coherent superposition of both of the electron being directly excited by the vacuum fluctuations, and the vacuum fluctuations causing the thing to bounce up and down, which also excite the electron. Those can both add and subtract. You can get coherent sums of those, and that's what gives you the 92%. So it's actually a result of this competition. Right. Not amount left over. It takes loads of orbits because it turns out that the coupling goes roughly as the time scale of the coupling goes roughly as, well, the time scale, I guess, goes roughly as the mass of the electron divided by the acceleration with appropriate units of h bar in there. So the times mass squared divided by the acceleration squared. So that becomes very, very long. As long as the acceleration isn't up to the acceleration, which would start producing pairs. But in a synchrotron, those things sit there for an hour or many hours, and that's plenty long enough for it to come into thermal equilibrium. In the linear accelerator like SLAC, unfortunately, the poor electron goes whipping through that linear accelerator far too fast for it to come into thermal equilibrium. It just takes far too long for it to get into thermal equilibrium. So the effect, one can argue that the effect has actually been observed. As I said, it's a more complicated situation, but yes. So what one expects of this thermal bath is to come in and start exciting this oscillator or this detector, and I'm going to be using a simple harmonic oscillator as my detector. The reason I'm using that instead of, for example, a two-level system like the spins of the electron is because this is far easier to analyze. Harmonic oscillators are a linear system. Two-level systems are not very nonlinear. And linear things are always easier to calculate than nonlinear ones. In this case, I'm not going to worry about detection. But for example, one could look at the oscillator and find that it's start off in its ground state and find that it's in an excited state. And then one would say that the oscillator has detected them. Or look at the oscillator in equilibrium and ask what are the equilibrium properties of this oscillator and see that the states, for example, are thermally populated. And one would find that the states would be thermally populated, whether it's in circular motion or in... Anyway, so what one expects of this, let us take this oscillator. These thermal photons are going to come in, get absorbed by the oscillator, but at the same time, this thing is excited, and so it's going to emit photons as well in equilibrium. The question is, what happens to those? Do those just cancel out, or do you actually get radiation emitted from the point of view of a static observer? So all of this has been described from the point of view of the accelerated observer. Now let's look at it from the point of view of the static observer, where you're in a state which is the vacuum state of the field. This thing is being accelerated through the vacuum state. It interacts with the vacuum fluctuations. Does this in net produce photons that go wandering out to infinity or not? Surprisingly enough, this has been a controversial topic now for about 30 years. And a few weeks ago, I got two papers on this subject from various and sundry of my colleagues still discussing it. And so I decided that it was time to clean up the subject. So this is very recent work on my part. This is the last couple of weeks. Now, Bob Wald and I, back in the 1980s, looked already at what happens to this detector if one starts it off in the ground state, and one asks what happens to that detector if one observes the detector, what kind of radiation do you get emitted? Things, of course, is that since you're starting off in the vacuum state, if that particle detector gets excited, what can the Minkowski observer see that excitation process as? It surely cannot be the absorption of anything because there's nothing to be absorbed. There aren't no particles in the vacuum. So what it corresponds to is, in fact, an emission of particles. Now, partly, it's rather strange, because from the point of view of the accelerated observer, he would say, look, there are all these thermal photons running around. I'm going to absorb one of them. That decreases the energy. So that course should correspond to a negative flux. Yet from the Minkowski observer's point of view, he says, oh, come on, this thing's emitting a photon. That's an increase in energy. In fact, the two are perfectly consistent. There's a very neat example of this. Let's say that you started off with a state which had zero particles plus an amplitude of 1/10 of having 100 particles. This should actually be square root of 1 minus 1/100 in there, but that's close enough to 1 that I'm not going to worry about it. The expectation value of the energy in this state is 1. Let's say 1 photon. Now we look at the detector and we find it's been excited. Well, the only thing that could have excited it was this part of the state, right? So after I've discovered that the electron has been excited, the state of the field that's been left has got 99 photons in it. And therefore, the energy of the state is 99, and it's gone from 1 to 99. Now, of course, in the particular case of our thermal bath, it's not this extreme, but once again, the oscillator or the detector will preferentially absorb photons from those parts of the thermal bath which have lots of photons in them, rather than from those parts of the thermal bath that have very few. As a result, after the absorption process, the thermal bath actually has more energy in it than it had before, and the two points of view are perfectly consistent with each other. So it's a fun little exercise. What also happens in that case is that if you measure the oscillator and find that it's not excited, that then from the Minkowski observer's point of view, the field is in a coherent superposition of zero, i.e. nothing happened to the oscillator, or the oscillator could have gotten excited and then de-excited again. So it's in a superposition of 0 plus 2, and we know that the expectation value of the energy in one of these cross states can actually be negative, can have negative fluxes, and one finds that it does. So there's some fun little bits of physics that go on in this. One of the reasons that I felt that I could sort of clean it up, if you will, was that way, way back when my second paper that I ever wrote was a paper on radiation reaction, electromagnetic radiation reaction. And looking at the radiation reaction force on the particle. Now we all know that the radiation reaction force looks something like this. I hope I've got the various factors right, but it looks something like this. The important thing is it depends on the third derivative of the third derivative of the position, the derivative of the acceleration. Now, in a sense, that's not unexpected. You know, what could it be? Well, it could depend on the velocity, but a force, a radiation reaction force, we know has to be orthogonal to the velocity, because the velocity vector has unit length, and so you can never, you know, it always has unit length, and therefore all accelerations, all forces must be orthogonal to the velocity. If this were second derivative, that would just be a renormalization of the mass of the system, and certainly wouldn't be any kind of radiation reaction force. So the first term that one would expect is, in fact, a third derivative. The big problem, of course, is that we know that if we look at the electromagnetic field, for example, the vector potential for a current, it diverges at the particle. The vector potential goes as 1 over x minus x prime, the distance between the two points, spatial distance between the two points. If we look at f mu nu, it diverges even more badly at the location of the particle. So how in the world can one calculate this radiation reaction force? And people have calculated this in a whole bunch of different ways. And what that paper was to show that there's even another way of calculating the radiation reaction force. And that was to use an idea of Penrose's, or well, actually a generalization that Penrose made of ideas Kirchhoff originally had, where one could show that the field at a point could be derived by taking a null cone going out of that point, taking the derivative of the field in a direction, in a null direction, which is sort of orthogonal. Well, with null directions, one always has difficulties. It's actually the vector L is dotted into the null vector that defines the generators is actually equal to 1. I don't know what one wants to call that. One would like to call it orthogonal, but that's, of course, completely wrong. L dot n is equal to 1. Take the derivative of the field in that direction, you put in some correction terms, and you find that the integral of that derivative over the null cone, over the 2 surface, an r equals constant 2 surface of the null cone, gives you exactly the value of the field here at the apex. Now, let's say that we take the radiation, the field caused by the radiation of this particle going through here. This integral is going to be finite. The radiation produced by the particle at a distance far away from the particle is finite. And the integral over this finite area is going to be finite. So one is going to, if one takes this integral over the field caused by the particle itself, this is going to be a finite number. One of the dangers, of course, is that zero, in which case things would not be very interesting. So you only need, well, yeah, you only need the future cone. Pardon? In flat four-dimensional. If it's not flat four-dimensional, in flat four-dimensional space-time, one finds that derivatives along this cone, the derivative of this argument along the radial direction is equal to zero. So there's a conserved quantity in here, so it doesn't matter which radius one chooses for this thing. So now one can now go ahead and do is to define the field at this point as being half of the average field that we get from doing this integral over the future null cone plus the integral of the field over the past null cone. Since this particle, of course, is emitting stuff into the future, the radiation reaction, the field due to the particle itself only has a term that comes from the future null cone. The incoming electromagnetic field has a contribution both from the past and from the future. And if you take half the past plus half the future as defining the field at the particle, you get exactly the radiation reaction field that, you know, everybody has known and loved for very many years. Well, part of the problem with half the difference between the advanced and retarded is that's a horrible guy anyway. It diverges as you get close to the particle as well. No, but the difference is also, I mean, it diverges. It's, trying to remember. Anyway, I'm not sure. It's another way of doing it. So the key thing is that the radiation reaction is that as long as the field obeys the massless equation outside of the source, this integral is a conserved quantity and is finite. And it just gives you the radiation reaction. There's a neat thing in that one can generalize this even, for example, to a dipole. Let's say that one has a little magnetic dipole sitting there, point dipole instead of a monopole. And one wants to ask, what's the effect of the electromagnetic field of that point dipole back on itself? One can do exactly the same kind of integral. In this case, one wants to calculate, for example, what is the field, what is the B field at the point of the particle, rather than the potentials and so forth. One goes through the same kind of integral, and one finds that the rate of change of the magnetic monopole, this is assuming it's unaccelerated. If it's accelerated, there are additional terms that come in here. The rate of change of the magnetic moment of the particle is just equal to the magnetic moment cross the third derivative, once again, of the magnetic moment. This is actually a very interesting expression. First thing you notice is that if you assume that this is actually supposed to be the angular momentum, because mu is the dipole moment. One notices that the direction of the magnitude of the angular momentum is conserved, because m dot, which is the derivative of m squared, into this thing is equal to zero, because that's a cross product. Furthermore, this solution also has runaway solutions. If one simply writes down these equations and solves them, one finds that there exist runaway solutions. And these are very interesting runaway solutions, because they're runaway solutions in the direction of this monopole, of this dipole moment. So the dipole moment sort of starts whirling around the sphere exponentially rapidly. Its magnitude of the angular momentum stays constant at all times, but its direction keeps going faster and faster as it points over this little sphere. So that was a fun little result that one can derive all using this radiation reaction formula. No. I mean, there you have to worry about the curvature of the space. No, I don't know the answer. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of related kind. I mean, big problem there is that you have curvature in your space-time sitting there, and that gets much harder to handle properly because these integrals are no longer conserved integrals. You get back reflection kind of contributions from the curvature. And so the integral is not simply the surface integral, there's correction terms that come from the whole light cone as you get down to the point as well. Gravitational radio. Oh, no, that's, I agree. And I mean, I've thought many times of trying to figure out how to use the same kind of ideas, and I haven't really managed to do that. I have sometimes thought about, there I wouldn't even dream of cleaning that up. That's such a messy problem that all I could do is maybe make some small contribution. But yes, I have thought of doing that. But I haven't done it, so I can't. Otherwise, I'd probably talk about that instead of the simple problem. So let me do two dimensions first. The second thing that I wanted to do was I realized in this work on the dipole moment that one could do things very simply if one went to a special coordinate system. For example, in this particular case, we've got this accelerated path of the particle, and I'm going to set up basically the null cones coming out of that particle. I'm going to label the null cones by the factor little u. W here is just t minus x. And little u is just going to be related to w. On this side, w tilde is t plus x. Little u is going to be related to both of those, but such that along the path of the particle, little u is just equal to the proper time along the path of the particle. And we can make a coordinate transformation from these wx coordinates to these uy coordinates by displacing x back, you know, measuring x from the world line of the particle instead of measuring x from some arbitrary zero, and also correcting the scaling of x. And if you correct the scaling of x by choosing h to just be equal to this capital W dot, W of tau is just the path of the particle in these wx coordinates. So capital W, capital X are just the path of the particle in the little w, little x coordinates. Going through this procedure, one gets a metric that looks like this. So it's a particularly simple form of the metric. Now, why is that interesting? That's interesting because if I take the scalar field, so I've now got a scalar field, I've got a harmonic oscillator as an internal coordinate, the scalar field couples to the harmonic oscillator, and in two dimensions, I choose that coupling to be a time derivative kind of coupling. Why do I choose it to be the time derivative coupling instead of just, for example, q phi? The reason is that A, once I solve for phi, I get an equation for phi that looks like this. The solution for phi is particularly simple in these coordinates. Phi is just equal to some free field plus epsilon by 2 q of u. So q of u just represents the position of this oscillator in this internal q coordinate at retarded time u. So the solution becomes particularly simple when I stick this back into the equations of motion for q. Lo and behold, all I get is a simple damped harmonic oscillator. Had I chosen q there instead of q dot, this equation would have had an integral over q in here instead of having q dot, which would be a much messier equation to try and solve, and in fact would have things like runaway solutions and so forth, which one would rather not have to handle. Yes? Epsilon is just the coupling, like the charge. Epsilon isn't time reversal invariant? Why not? Oh, yeah. Well, this is friction in the oscillator. Okay. This is basically the dot product between the derivative of q with the proper, with the direction, the direction that you're going along the path. So if you went back into the past, you would simply, you'd pick up an extra minus sign in there from, because the proper velocity would flip sign as well. So one can argue that this is time symmetric. So one can solve for Q now in terms of the free field phi naught, and one simply gets the usual kind of integral, the Green's function for Q, as a function of this forcing term. There's of course initial terms in there as well. If one were to start the oscillator off in some initial state at some time U naught, but I'm assuming that those are all infinitely far in the past, and I'm going to ignore them. What I want to look at is the equilibrium situation where everything is settled down for an arbitrarily long time. Gamma is epsilon squared by 2. Gamma is epsilon squared by 4, sorry. Yes. Well, the stress energy tensor for the scalar field we all know and love. It just looks like this. It's just products of first derivatives of the field phi. In our particular case, the field phi is equal to a free field, a background free field, plus this term that comes from the oscillator itself. The important term, in fact, about the only term that survives, is the TRU term. Which looks like this, plus a term which is equal to just the stress energy tensor of the free field itself. Now we're going to be doing quantum mechanics, and we're going to be doing quantum mechanics in the vacuum state, and in particular the stress energy tensor of the scalar, of the free scalar field in its vacuum state, we're going to assume is equal to zero. It's of course equal to infinity, but we assume that we can normalize that, and in particular there's not going to be any flux that goes out at infinity. So one gets an equation that looks like this. It's a rather messy equation, but if one looks basically at these equations when R goes to infinity, i.e. one wants to look purely at the radiation that escapes out to infinity, these equations actually become much simpler. Quantum mechanics, this is a linear system, so the quantum Heisenberg equations of motion are precisely the same as the ordinary classical equations of motion, where we simply interpret everything as operators rather than interpreting them as C numbers. Furthermore, anytime we have products in there, those products are supposed to be the symmetric product. So one half of the anti-commutator of Q and phi instead of Q dot times phi dot. F in this case is the acceleration. Instead of using A, I've used F to designate the acceleration. If we look at these expectation values, then we know that inside Q is an integral over phi naught, right? From that Green's function thing before. So what comes into these expectation values of this term is the expectation value of phi of u r as r goes out to infinity, and phi of u, that should have been u primed, at zero, where zero is the point where the particle is actually sitting. Furthermore, terms that look like q dot squared, which occurred in my stress energy tensor, each of these q's is just simply an integral over phi. What happened here? This is phi 0 at u primed at 0 and 0, which is turns out just to be the logarithm of this guy. This guy turns out to be the logarithm of r plus the logarithm of these factors of u. We can now stick this, there's another little trick that we can play in, that we can rewrite the expectation value of Q, Q dot, by rewriting Q dot occurs in the equations of motion for the harmonic oscillator in terms of Q double dot, Q itself, and phi. When we do that, then the terms that go as q double dot times q dot are the same as just the time derivative of q dot squared. And since we're in equilibrium, q dot squared is a constant. So that's zero. This term, q times q dot, is just the time derivative of q squared. And so it's also equal to zero. So all of those terms drop out. All we're left with is this one term. Plug that into the stress energy tensor, and we find that the flux at infinity is just given by epsilon by 2 q dot times phi dot at r equals infinity minus 1/2 of phi dot at r equals zero. Now, when we take the expectation value of this, lo and behold, all of these logarithms mean that this whole term, and that this term, the correlation between these phis and the phi that's hitting in here, turn out to just be proportional to u. And when I take the second time derivative of u, I get zero. So there's no energy emitted by an oscillator in two dimensions. Right. Right. It's a solution of the equations of motion for the phi field. That's it. No, the epsilon is simply the coupling. It's the coupling between the oscillator and the field. So it's just, it's like the charge in the electron. Yes. Uniformly accelerated motion. So here I've restricted myself to uniformly accelerated motion. If you have non-uniformly accelerated motion, then you will get radiation. So at some point in there, I assumed that, for example, the path of the particle was just equal to, t was equal to sinh times the acceleration times 1 over the acceleration times sinh times the acceleration times u. And x was cosh minus 1. Right. Right. No, no. This is the flux out at r equals infinity. And r equals infinity. In this coordinate system, r equals infinity really is r equals infinity in flat spacetime. So if I look at the energy emitted, the energy flux at infinity, I find out that in both directions, the energy flux is equal to zero. For a uniformly accelerated oscillator, which has been allowed to come into equilibrium with the thermal field that it sees due to its acceleration. If f is not uniformly accelerated, then you do get terms that look like f dot and so forth that come into the equations. Well, then f is not a constant acceleration, so one would have to go through, and I haven't done the calculation. Yes. 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 One would certainly expect the total energy to be radiated to be positive in that case. It's somewhat surprising because if you look at an accelerated mirror, you get negative fluxes given off on one side and positive fluxes given off on the other side for a uniform accelerated mirror. And so, in two dimensions, an oscillator in equilibrium doesn't radiate. At least, assuming all of my calculations in the last 2 weeks have been right. That's always a caveat that one always worries about. Four dimensions. Okay, in four dimensions one can build up the same kind of coordinate system as one had in two dimensions. Namely, one sets up one's coordinate system such that you have null cones emanating from each point along the path of the particle. U labels each one of these null cones. F, once again, is the acceleration. R is the affine parameter along the null cone, along the generators of this null cone. And R is chosen such that the cross term in the metric is twice du dr. So that's how R is chosen. That turns out also to be an aerial coordinate. Theta is the angle as measured from the direction of the acceleration. So the acceleration is in this plane, and I'm assuming uniform acceleration, so the acceleration changes, doesn't change in direction either. So that defines one's a coordinate system that's just like that flat space coordinate system before. And the metric looks slightly messier than it did in flat space, but not all that messier. So we get some angular dependence, cos thetas and sine thetas coming in there. We get an extra cross term between du and d theta, which depends on the acceleration. But in the theta phi direction, this is a nice uniform spheres, as you would expect. The scalar field, what do we choose for the scalar field this time? For the scalar field, we don't have laser pointers, do we? ITP doesn't. Okay. That's okay. I'll just point here, as I've been doing so far. So again, we use the straightforward action for the scalar field as we had before. This time the coupling is not a time-dependent coupling. This time the coupling is purely between Q and phi. And the ordinary dot product, the ordinary Hamiltonian for the scalar field. Dot here represents derivatives with respect to proper time. In fact, that coordinate u that I had before is just the proper time along the path of the particle. No. I just said, in this case, we do not use have a q dot in there. In this case, we have only a q. Why do we choose the q in this case? We will discover that that will produce exactly the damped harmonic oscillator that we want. And if we had a q dot in there, we'd get a q triple dot in the equations of motion for the harmonic oscillator. Okay, so the equations of motion for the scalar field look like this. In this particular case, the reason I chose the coordinates I did, because the solution for the field of the oscillator is particularly simple. It's just q of u divided by r. That's it. There's no angular dependence. There's no complicated u dependence. There's no complicated r dependence. It's just q over r. And that's the key reason for choosing that coordinate system. Plus, we have the free field over here. The coupling constant now goes as epsilon over 4 pi. So the question, so we've got this field that looks like this. This, of course, diverges as we get close to the point of the particle. What's the value of this field at the particle position? Because after all, that's what we want in order to look at the equations of motion for the harmonic oscillator. Well, again, what we use is the Penrose-Kirchhoff integral to do it. And lo and behold, we find that the field at the particle is just the free field at the particle minus epsilon over 4 pi times the time derivative of q with respect to tau, or with respect to u, with respect to the proper time. Right. Right, so this is the field away from the particle, and at the particle you've got the radiation reaction field, I mean just as an electromagnetism. At the particle you have the radiation reaction field, and that radiation reaction field just looks like this. So the particle itself, all it sees is not this divergent field right at itself, but just something that looks like this. We now want to, the Penrose-Kirchhoff integral is again this half advanced minus half retarded of a derivative along the L vector, which is the null vector pointing across that null cone, defined such that L times the radial vector is equal to 1, etc. There's a correction term, 1 over R, like this. And only the retarded, for this thing, the only the retarded integral is non-zero, turns out to be just this term here. So the equation of motion for the simple harmonic oscillator is again just a simple damped harmonic oscillator with the ordinary damping term. And that was why I chose that epsilon q phi coupling, because if I had chosen an epsilon q dot phi coupling, this term here would be q triple dot, and I don't want that. It's got, I can't solve it. It's got runaway solutions. It's horrible. No. Why would I want one? I never want a q triple dot term. That may be, but I don't want it. It has all kinds of pathologies, and I can't, I mean, if I did any calculations with a Q triple dot term in there, I simply wouldn't trust any answers that I got. Right, the big problem with a coupling a charge to the electromagnetic field is that you don't, is that the motion of the electron is in the same space-time as that it's accelerating. So its acceleration would then change because of its own motion. And one would then have to go ahead and redo all of these equations, assuming a non-constant acceleration in arbitrary directions, and you'd have this horrible mess. So the Q isn't in a space, is just, it's the charge of this, it's the scalar charge of this little oscillator, and that scalar charge has got a restoring force on it, which brings it back to zero with a normal oscillatory frequency of omega. So I get to pick the coupling in this case. I want to do an easy problem because I have enough trouble solving them, never mind the difficult ones. But this is sort of the standard kind of calculation that, this is the simple standard calculation that people have done and that people have disagreed with. Again, the integral, the q, we can solve this for q as an arbitrary function. We're again going to assume that the initial state is far enough into the past that we don't have to worry about it. This thing has come into equilibrium. We're going to assume that the acceleration is constant, is not a variable acceleration, and ask what does the radiation given off by infinity look like. So once again, we can write q in terms of the free field, which is going to be the free quantum field, phi, given in its ground state, in its unexcited state. Omega tilde here is omega squared minus gamma squared, where gamma is epsilon squared over 4 pi. So once again, we can look at the energy momentum tensor. Same kind of thing as we did in two dimensions. We get three terms. We get the sort of free field energy momentum tensor. That we're going to assume is equal to zero once again. That's just, there's going to be a quantum field, which we're going to assume is in its vacuum state. It's not going to have any radiation contained in it. There's going to be the QQ kind of term, which is going to look like this. And then there's going to be a Q, a coupling between the Q and the background field, a term which looks like this. And we want the quantum expectation value, so once again we need to look at the expectation value of the free field, phi naught, and we know what the expectation value of the free field, or the correlation function, or the Whiteman function of the free field phi naught looks like. It just looks like this guy over here. 1 over 4 pi times the proper distance between the two points. So we got to calculate what the proper distance between the two points. If we assume constant acceleration, then this is the vector that we're trying to calculate the length of. This vector from the point u to the point r is a null vector. This vector here from the point u prime to the point u is a time-like vector. Go through the calculation, and one finds that x minus x primed has got a term that is just linear in R, times a bunch of sinches, cosine thetas, cosches, plus a term that is independent of R, which is basically just the length of this vector in here, which is cosh f minus 1. 1 over f squared times cosh f minus 1. F, remember, is the acceleration. Note that this is angularly dependent. So in looking at the energy flux at infinity, we've got to be a little bit more careful than before. We cannot just look at TUR. We have to try and define what we mean by the energy. And what I'm going to mean by the energy is defined by the time-like, the ordinary time translation killing vector in this space-time, where I'm going to choose that time translation killing vector to be parallel to the particle at u equals 0. The point in the same direction as the particle at u equals 0. So I'm going to look at the flux of this energy, which is EU, which is T mu nu times that killing vector, at infinity. And the rate of change of energy is just going to be, well, it's not the radial component of E, it's the radial component of the cross product between E and the time-like killing vector. So one gets, it's messier. One finds that the various components look like this. The time rate of change of energy flow at infinity due to the EQQ looks like this term over here. Notice that we're going to get Q dot time Q terms. Those are going to be zero, again, because everything is, that's just the derivative of Q squared, and by assumption, Q squared is a constant. So those kinds of terms are going to be zero, but we're going to get a Q dot squared and an F squared times Q squared that comes into that expression. Similarly, the cross terms between the radiation produced by the particle and the free field, we get this kind of a messy integral sitting over here. Now, in the two-dimensional case, this term and this term cancel. But we can see already that it can't cancel in four dimensions, because this term is basically spherically symmetric. Well, there's a q squared cos squared, but the angular dependence of this thing is very simple. But the angular dependence of this guy depends on the expectation value of phi naught at r equals infinity, with phi naught down here at r equals 0. And that has cosine dependences coming into it, because that distance depends on, you know, where around the circle we're looking at the thing. It has, in fact, rather ugly kinds of angular dependence. If f equals 0, we don't want there to be any radiation, because this is just a harmonic oscillator sitting in the vacuum at rest. It better not radiate. And lo and behold, the q dot squared and this term just cancel each other out. So that's at least a consistency check. We can again use the equations of motion for u, plug it in, and you finally get this messy expression. And one of the things that we notice, this term is just proportional cosine squared of theta, and it would have to cancel with these terms in here. There's just no way it can cancel. So in four dimensions, there actually is an angular dependent radiation. So the energy that's emitted out at infinity looks like this. This S of u is simply that sine omega t divided by omega times e to the minus gamma t term, the Green's function for the harmonic oscillator, and this is just the correlation function for the field phi. And we can look at the plots of these two guys, and they're certainly not trivial. So this is a plot of the function as a function of theta and as a function of u. It has this very complicated cosine dependence. As f of u gets very large, it's positive almost everywhere except on a very, very narrow cone at theta equals pi, which is in the opposite direction to the direction in which the particle is accelerating. So there's a little bit of negative energy radiation that gets spewed out in that backwards direction, but in all other directions you get this positive energy radiation with a rather complicated angular dependence to it. We'll look at the total radiation. The negative never does win out over the positive, and the total radiation just looks like this as a function of u. Now what I have to do is to multiply this by that s and integrate it over u to find out how much energy is actually emitted. That's going to depend on the frequency of the harmonic oscillator, it's going to depend on gamma of the harmonic oscillator. This is a very ugly function. We can express these integrals in terms of polygamma functions, but it would be absolutely useless. I mean, it wouldn't be very illuminating if I were to do that, unless somebody here really knows their polygamma functions very well. None. So it's a vacuum state, so what I have is the vacuum state for the field phi zero. Okay? There's no incoming radiation. All there is this outgoing radiation due to the acceleration of this detector, of this oscillator. One can talk a little bit about radiation reaction, and I haven't really managed to finish up this calculation, so I can only tell you some of the results. There's the energy, if you will, the part that depends on the motion of the oscillator is this complicated term over here. I could define a mass function for this guy that looks like this, and then my equation of motion for the oscillator would have to look like this, is equal to some external force. So this is just the variation of this action with respect to x, which gives me the equations of motion of the oscillator. That's got to be equal to some external force. And one has to have an external force here which pushes the particle around. We can rewrite that in the following way. If we define the energy of the harmonic oscillator as just 1/2 q dot squared plus omega squared q squared, that's the usual energy, then we find that the energy times the second derivative times the acceleration plus a force term, and that force term as usual is orthogonal to the velocity of the particle, as relativistic forces are supposed to be, that's got to be equal to the external force. We can ask, what's the radiation reaction part of this? So we just look for the parts that have to do with the radiation reaction, do the standard Penrose-Kirchhoff integral, and we get a term that looks like this, epsilon over 6 pi times the acceleration dot, times q. The acceleration times that is that. So the actual force goes as the acceleration dot, just as you get in ordinary electrodynamics. And it's what we expected by that generic argument that I gave before. But it's nice that the Penrose-Kirchhoff integral gives you exactly that result. So since F is assumed to be a constant, the radiation reaction force is equal to zero. So all of the energy balance must contain itself in that coupling between the harmonic oscillator and the background field, phi zero, and correlations between the motion of the oscillator and the background field. The problem is these calculations are not particularly simple, because effectively the mass of the harmonic oscillator is in this, you know, q dot squared plus omega squared q squared term, but there's also a radiation polarization field surrounding that charge. That also contributes to the mass of the oscillator. And one has to take into account both of those terms in the accelerating force before one can see, you know, what part of the accelerating force actually produces the energy that gets radiated off to infinity. So at this point, the main conclusion I have is that despite what half the people say and in agreement with what half the other people say, a uniformly accelerated oscillator in four dimension does radiate energy out to infinity, even if it's after it's settled down to equilibrium. That's all I have to say. No, you wouldn't expect it to be thermal, because it's given off by this particle, right? And immediately that particle accelerates, and so the next radiation that's given off is going to be red-shifted or blue-shifted, depending on which side you're on. So if you're on the side where the particle is moving away from you and coming back, it's going to be very low frequency when it's going away from you and become very high frequency, whoop, you know, as it comes towards you. And you're going to get hit by this blast, and eventually you're going to get hit by the particle as well. Whereas if you're on the other side, it's very high frequency as it's coming towards you, and then low frequency as it goes away from you. So one of the mistakes that many people make is the sort of mistake of saying that for the Minkowski observer, for an accelerated particle, you're going to see this thermal radiation given off by this accelerated system. The answer is you don't. That's just wrong. You get this very bursty kind of and frequency dependent kind of radiation. So it looks very cold when it's going away from you, and very hot when it's coming towards you. Now, if somehow you could sort of accelerate in the same way as the particle, but then that's hard to do at infinity. So no, it's not thermal, and you wouldn't expect it to be thermal. Even if you did it in the same accelerating kind of frame, you wouldn't expect it to be thermal. Well, no, there you have the trouble, of course, that you would, of course, see the surrounding massless, the surrounding free field as being a thermal field as well. And in that case, this oscillator would just disappear into the thermal bath that you saw around you. Yes? No, I haven't done that. And the problem there is that you do get radiation going off through that future horizon. You've got a future horizon sitting there. And, you know, radiation is sort of pouring out through there. And now is the subtraction between the thermal radiation that you would expect without the oscillator there, or the radiation with the oscillator there, equal to zero? I'm not sure what I would expect. In a sense, what's happening here is that the oscillator acts as a scattering center, and as a result, the radiation in the background field, which is just this thermal radiation, there are correlations, you know, the radiation traveling in this way keeps traveling in this direction. So there are correlations set up because of that between the radiation over here and the radiation over here. With a scattering center there, there are correlations between the radiation traveling in this direction and the radiation traveling in this direction, which wouldn't have been there without the scattering center there. So you get these sort of weird correlations, which could produce some sort of energy for you. But it's hard, I've found it hard to think my way through that. Right, I'm not sure that that would be the right answer there. I mean, I feel the same pull of that explanation as you do. Yes, yeah. The problem is in the other case in this coordinate system, it's really hard for me to see how those terms can cancel out, because some of them have very complicated angular dependences to them, and the others don't. and it's hard to see how two terms like that can cancel. I was slightly surprised that the total energy was actually positive, so that there was a total, you know, one could imagine that there's a negative flux of energy off in one direction and a positive flux off in the other direction, so that those integrated up to give zero. That doesn't seem to be happening in this case. Now, as I said at the beginning, modulo mistakes. I got nothing more to say unless somebody has a question, and then I'll try and answer it.